for less than that. Whatever that was. Well, good morning. We're in the book of Romans. I hope you found an outline laying around. You'll notice on the outline there are a lot of blanks. I hope that you will find you a pencil or a pen and fill them out as we go. I try to figure out what word I want to leave the blank at. You ever thought about that? I try to choose key words to leave for the blank, but also words that I can spell, or maybe can't spell. The book of Romans is a unique book. It's not just like all the other New Testament books. It's not like, although it was written by Paul, like I think about 11 or 12 other New Testament books, where it's different. It's a unique book in the sense that it is an orderly progression of thought. One point builds upon another. And this morning, as I go through the outline, I won't be going through in the order that the text is going, but I'll be following 6 points that build upon one another that Paul makes in these verses 18 through 32 of chapter 1. But to begin with, let's read the text. Romans chapter 1, beginning reading in verse 18. Let me back up let's back up to verse 14, where Paul says, I am debtor both to the Greeks and to the barbarians, both to the wise and to the unwise. And let's stop there just for a second. He has two phrases. Each phrase names two groups of people. Paul says, I am a debtor, or I owe something to both the Greeks and the barbarians. Now, who are these people? I think that Paul is saying everybody. He's lumping everybody in the world into two groups, the Greeks and the non-Greeks. The non-Greeks being what the Greeks called barbarians. There's no country of Barbaria, right? It's the Greeks and those people who the Greeks considered unsophisticated. The Greeks were philosophical thinkers, and they had lifted themselves up, they thought, in their own minds above everybody else in the world. Paul says, I'm a debtor to carry the gospel to both the Greeks and the barbarians. The next two phrases say the same thing, just in different terms, both to the wise, that's the Greeks, or at least they thought they were wise, and to the unwise, that's everybody but the Greeks, who the Greeks did not think were wise. So what Paul is saying is, I'm a debtor to carry the gospel to the world, to everybody. Verse 15, so as much as is in me is, I am ready to preach the gospel to you that are at Rome also. So part of his carrying this out was his plans to go to Rome and preach the gospel to them. For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believes, to the Jew first, but also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. Then we begin our text, verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who hold the truth, or suppress the truth, in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath showed it unto them. For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because that when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man, and to birds, and four-footed beasts, and creeping things. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their own hearts, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves, which changed the truth of God into a lie, and worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this cause God also gave them up unto vile affections, for even their women did change the natural use into that which is against nature. And likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust one toward another, men with men, working that which is unseemly, and receiving in themselves that recompense of their error which was meet. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things which are not convenient, being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affections, implacable, unmerciful, who knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. These 15 verses, I think it's 15 verses, are some of the most potent 15 verses in all of the Holy Scriptures. They are often quoted. As we look at them, I want you to pay close attention and look at the points, because as I said, the book of Romans builds point upon point through the first 10 or 11 chapters. And you need to grasp what these verses are saying, because what follows, the chapters ahead, builds upon this. Now, there are a lot of people in Christian churches around the United States, around Arkansas, around Cleburne County, who would say, when we go through this, I believe this. But when push comes to shove, somewhere down the road, they'll find that they are backing off of these truths. Now, let's look at them and see what we see here. The first point is this, that the gospel implies the existence of its antithesis. There's a big word. All right. What does that mean? Opposite. The gospel implies the existence of its opposite. Now, I could have used the word opposite, but I wanted to impress you. All right. The gospel implies the existence of its antithesis. Let me give you an example of that. My wife has had several surgeries. And when she goes back into surgery, and later on she's there for a while, whatever, and later on the doctor or the nurse comes out, and the doctor says, I've got good news. How do I respond to that? It's, whew. There's been a tension there within me that I really didn't know was there. I knew it was there, but not to the extent until I let my breath out, until I relax. Why is that? Because there was the possibility that he would come out and say something different. He would not be saying, I've got some good news. So just those words, which the word gospel, right, means good news. Just those words, good news or gospel, implies that there the possibility exists that all may not have been well. So when Paul says, I'm ready to go and preach the gospel, the implications are that things, there is a gospel to preach, that there are a gospel to be had, a gospel to be desired in our country. Churches have gotten away from showing why the gospel is good news. We have the tendency to be careful when we preach the bad news. When we tell about man's condition, I even I shouldn't say be tempted, but the thought has crossed my mind, are people going to think this is too harsh? Are people going to think this is too rough? Are people going to think this is a little strong? But the good news, gospel news, usually means bad news was avoided. All of us have probably had this experience, but I see a person going through life. And this person has struggles. It seems like they make one bad decision after another, and their life is just full of chaos. And it's over and over and over again, and I'm close enough to them that I know them, and I know that really deep inside, their thoughts and their desires are not for God. They have little use for God. And I find myself thinking, man, what you really need is God. What you really need is the Lord. And maybe some of this foolish stuff that you're getting caught up in would kind of drop by the wayside. And that kind of thinking is very close to being in error. Because we do not need the gospel to make our lives better. That may be a byproduct, and it may not be. But we need the gospel because there is bad news. Paul doesn't say, I'm ready to preach the gospel to you because it will make your life better. He doesn't say, I'm ready to preach the gospel to you because God has a wonderful plan for your life. No. He says, I am ready to preach the gospel to the Jew, to the Greek, to everyone, because the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. That is why the gospel is needed. In theology, the revealing of the gospel is an example of what we call special revelation, or what theologians call special revelation. Now, I want to distinguish that in the next point, so we'll save that and come back to that term. So the first point is, the gospel implies the existence or the possibility of its opposite. Does everyone follow that? Everyone see the point? Number two, God has revealed some things to all men everywhere. The terms in the blanks are key terms. God has revealed some things. Not everything. God has revealed some things to all men everywhere. What are those things? In theology, we call this general revelation. God has revealed some things to everybody. Everybody in Arkansas, everybody in New Guinea, everybody in communist China, everybody in Russia, everybody. God has revealed some things to everybody everywhere. Notice what our text says. Two or three things that God has revealed. Verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed. Now this is a kind of a summary term that wraps us all up, and we'll kind of explain to that a little bit better as we go through there. But one thing that God has revealed from heaven to all men is His wrath. God's wrath is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness. Number two, the second thing that he's revealed is found in verse 19. Look at what it says. Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them. Them is the unrighteous men of the earth. Because God has shown it to them. God has shown all men some knowledge about himself. The third thing, that it's getting a little more specific, in verse 20. For the invisible things of God, for the invisible things of God, things that you just cannot walk up and touch. The invisible things of God from the creation of the world, from the very beginning of the created world, are clearly seen. This is not a fuzzy picture. This is clearly seen. Being understood. It's not just seen, it's understood by the things that are made. So what is he saying here? There are some things about God that I just can't go up and touch God. God is not, doesn't have a body like you and I. We can't go visit him. We can't touch him. But Paul says there are some things about God, though you may not can see him, you can see these things. You can understand some things about God by what he has made in creation. You can look at the order that we see in creation on the earth, in flowers, in a wasp nest, in the heavens, all over the place, in your eyes, in your ears, all over the place. There's incredible order. And that order helps us and lets us and forces us to understand something. That God exists. That there is a God. And there are certain things about God, Paul says in the last part of this verse, that it tells us. His eternal power and his deity, his Godhead. It tells us first that this Creator is a sovereign God over all of the earth and over me. It tells us that he is a powerful God, a God who can do all that he wants, all that he needs to do, and that he is a just God because his wrath is revealed against injustice. His wrath is revealed against unrighteousness. These things are revealed to everyone in the world. This is not all that there is to God, but it's enough. It's enough revealed to you and to me. Let's go on to verse 3. Point number 3. We're going to come to this word wrath. And I want us to talk about this word just for a second. We think of the word wrath, we think of something that ought not to be. We think of something that's wrong. When we read this further, wrath of God, we think, I wouldn't have thought God would have had wrath. Now let me explain a little bit the difference between God's wrath and mine. If you could line up on this wall every instance where I was angry, and you could line them up on this wall and have a, let's just say, a 5-second video clip of my anger in every instance, and they're lined up on this wall, and we would need this wall, too. Okay? We'd need this wall. And we watched these clips. 99 0.9% of them would be ugly. They would be shameful. I wouldn't want you to see them. I wouldn't want to watch them. Would you want yours? Let's not do mine. Let's do yours. Okay? Would you want video clips of your wrath displayed for us all to watch? I would. I don't. I said 99.9% of mine would be ugly, shameful, repulsive. I leave just a little room hoping that somewhere in there there was an instance or two of righteous indignation, but I kind of doubt it. When we think of wrath, that's what we think of. That's not God's wrath. God's wrath is not something like a volcano erupting. God's wrath is a determination. Let me perhaps illustrate it like this. When I was a kid, I experienced this in our car. When all our family was going down the road in a car, my dad would be driving, my mom over here, and me and my two sisters would be in the back seat. When I got grown, Mark and Daniel were kids, similar thing. I was driving, Susan was in the other seat, and Mark and Daniel in the back seat. And a very common thing that happens is the kids get to fussing. And they get to fight in the back seat. You tell them to quit and be quiet, and you're trying to drive. And so, you know, you're driving along, you know, trying to swat them from the front seat. Y'all ever done that? It's not the best swat, okay? And occasionally, this would happen. The dad, whether it was me or my dad, would have enough of it. Warnings had been given. Here's what he would say. When we get home, y'all go to your room, sit on the bed, wait till I get there. I don't care if we were 2 minutes from the house or if we were 30 minutes from the house, there was not another word spoken in the car. Was Dad about to blow his top? No. Dad was calm. Dad wasn't a volcano about to erupt, but they knew, and when I was a kid, I knew, that Dad was determined. Dad was going to see it through. No amount of begging and pleading and crying and wailing could I do that was going to undo what he had promised he was going to do. In a similar way, but don't make every point the same, God's wrath is similar to that. God has said, this is just. This is right. This is the moral code by which you are to live. And this is the punishment. Nothing in all of the world will take away that punishment. God's wrath is revealed from heaven. I see it. I know it. I believe it. Point number three is this. These things, the things that we can see about God through all of nature, through all of creation, these things, is a key word, are sufficiently understood. We may not understand them completely, but we understand enough about them. You follow me? These things are sufficiently understood that they eliminate an excuse of ignorance. Notice what he says in verse 20. The invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Creation informs men everywhere of God's sovereignty and eternal power. And our understanding of this is sufficient that it renders us excuseless. There are no excuses. All men know that they should glorify and worship God. Look in verse 21. Because that when they knew God, when they knew these things about God, when they understood these things about God sufficiently, still they would not glorify God, nor worship God. Notice in verse 32, all men everywhere understand that God will righteously judge their actions. Look in verse 32, who knowing the judgment of God, they know His wrath is coming. They know judgment is coming. They know that. Notice what it says, that they which commit such things are worthy of death. They know it's wrong. They know that if they got justice, they would die. They are worthy of death. And yet, what does it say? They not only do them, but take pleasure in other people who do them. You know, I've done a lot of evil things in my life. Most of them I did as a Christian. I'm 60 years old. I was converted when I was 8 years old. I've lived 52 years of my life as a Christian. Just the time ought to tell you that I've sinned more as a Christian than as a little boy. Right? But it's not just that. I understood a lot more about sin when I was 18, when I was 25, than I did when I was 6. So it's not just a greater amount of time. It's a greater amount of understanding. It's a greater amount of responsibility. It's a greater amount of accountability. And I can tell you that I regret my sin. I regret my evil. And that the guilt that I feel over sinning myself is enough. I'll tell you a greater guilt that I feel. There are one or two instances, or three or four, or five or six, I don't know how many. But there are a few instances in my teenage and young adult life where not only did I sin, but I introduced somebody else to sin. I felt horrible. Shortly after doing it, I felt shame. That I still feel. Paul says in this last verse, verse 32, these people, they know the judgment of God, and not only do they do it, but it gives them great pleasure to see other people doing it with them. We are without excuse. Another thing, the last point under number 3, and we won't discuss this because it's not in our text, but all men also have a moral code. Now, see, I've got that quote. That is written on their heart and conscience. So it's not just that we see God's creation in the world. God shows us things about Him in creation. But it's not just that. But He's also written on our hearts and in our conscience enough about Himself and enough about what is right and wrong to condemn us when we sin. And we'll see that in chapter 2. We're not going to go to there, but you can read that verse. Number 4, so what have we got so far? The gospel implies its opposite. The gospel implies that there is a possibility of bad news. Number 2, God has revealed some things to everybody. Through general revelation, He's revealed through creation, through the heavens and the earth and all that is made, enough about Himself to everyone in the world that they are without excuse. Then we get to number 4. All men, by nature, despise this knowledge. The things they see about God, the things they know about God, they despise it, they hate it, and they resist God's rule over them. They suppress the truth. Verse 18, this is the issue. It says they suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Men know this about God and they bury it. They try to keep it from coming out to the forefront of their thoughts and their knowledge. They do everything within their power to do away with it, to ignore it, to do something with it so they don't have to think about it. They will not glorify the God they know. Verse 21, when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God. The next phrase, when they knew God, they would not be grateful to Him. They would not give Him thanks. They would not bless His name. The fourth thing, they declare themselves to be enlightened. Verse 22, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. Surely, as we go through this, you can see things in our world that remind you of these things. We support, you saw the ministry of their answers in Genesis, a creation ministry. How many times have you heard or seen some enlightened person mock creation science? Because they are enlightened, and anyone who would believe that there is a God who created the earth is just a primitive fool. Just an ignorant somebody. They don't have the knowledge that they have. Professing themselves to be wise, they become fools. This is what happens when men despise God. They change God into an image of their own making. Now, this is not idol, it is idol worship, but it's not making a little idol out of a piece of wood or a piece of stone and setting it on your desk and bowing down to it. People can change God's image into something in their mind. They don't have to have an object necessarily. They fabricate lies about God's nature and attributes and worship this acceptable deity. People despise God, and so they change their definition of God. They change what they're going to call God into something, notice this, that they can live with. They change their notion of God, how they would define God. They change the attributes of God into something that they like. I want to do this, so I'm going to change the way I view about God into a God who likes it too, or who will accept me in this behavior. The next one, they do not value any knowledge about God or from God. One of the most frustrating things for me to watch is Fox News. I don't even try to watch CNN or any of the others. But it doesn't matter what's going on in the world. And I would give you, for example, school shootings. School shootings have been happening, right? You see all these talking heads that don't explain to you what happened and what we need and what we don't need, and there's a little debate back and forth. Never yet have I heard them say, anybody say, the real problem is we don't fear God. The real problem is a spiritual problem. I have yet to hear anyone mention anything about God in their solution. You can take away the guns, you can take away the knives, you can do all these things, and all these things are going to correct it. You can throw money at it, give people a better education, and all this kind of stuff. Is that going to solve it? No, because it is a spiritual problem of people who hate God. And they want to dismiss Him. So you never hear a word mentioned about that connection between God and my behavior. Are between God and the school shooter's behavior. I don't know how many of you read the Sun-Times, the local county paper, but this past week, the sheriff wrote an article. You need to read it. I was going to run it off and make some copies and give it out, but it got thrown away before I could. He mentioned it. He talks about the school shooting and stuff, and he brings the connection to a spiritual need, a spiritual void in this country. A good article. I encourage you to read it. They hate God. People despise this knowledge because they hate God. Notice in verse 30, he has this list of behaviors that people do. One of the behaviors he has listed here, they are haters of God. And the last one, they take great pleasure in resisting God and encouraging others to do the same. So, where are we at? The gospel implies bad news. Good news implies there's possibility of bad news. God has revealed some things to everybody about Himself. The things God has revealed to everybody about Himself are sufficient to condemn them, sufficient to leave them without excuse. And the things that we see about God by nature and in nature, we hate. We do not want this God. We do not want Him to rule over our lives. We do not want anyone to rule over us. We want to be our own king, our own God. So we resist. We despise. We change up God to fit something that we can live with. We dismiss Him. We won't talk about Him. We don't believe in Him. We're atheists. I always liked Ray Comfort's the title to his book, God Doesn't Believe in Atheists. Subtitle, Proof that the Atheist Doesn't Exist. I thought that was pretty clever. You know, someone may say they're an atheist. I'm not going to debate with them, but I'll tell you this. God knows more about them than they know about themselves. God doesn't believe they're atheists. He tells us in these verses, everybody knows something about God. And it's enough to condemn them. They can say they're atheists if they want, because they don't like to retain God in their knowledge. They can say that they're enlightened, but they're just professing themselves to be wise, and they, in the result, become fools. They'll do everything they can to suppress this truth about God that they clearly see and understand from nature. Gives us to point number five. As a result, As a result of us despising God, God's wrath or God's judgment permeates our lives. Now, what does the word permeate mean? Saturate, that's a good word. Okay? It sort of fills all the voids. Okay? My use of that word is perhaps not quite that extensive, but let's see. As a result, God's wrath or judgment permeates our lives. First point is this: God's judgment is seen in the ordinary pain and suffering caused by our sin. We've all experienced that. We've all experienced the consequences of our sin. We've all experienced pain. We've all experienced suffering. We've all experienced heartache and turmoil because of our sinful actions at some point or another. Now, when I say that statement, and I say this is God's judgment, God's wrath revealed from heaven, you know what I think to myself? Well, it's not so bad. I can live with that. I've been living with it for 60 years. Right? We get accustomed to God's judgment. That's all we know. But that's not all there is. This permeation of God's judgment touches every area of our lives, though usually not wholly, W-H-O-L-L-Y. In other words, God's judgment touches me, but not just, I'm not as bad as I could be, right? I might get angry and it might wreak havoc in my home. I could be angrier. Right? It could be worse. I may be a drunk and beat up my wife once every 6 months, but it could be worse. You know, I could beat her up every month. Right? No. No. We don't want to do that, right? But you see what I'm saying? All of us sin, but very few of us are as bad as we could be in every particular area. Yet this judgment of God touches every area of my life. Now, next point is critical. The intensity of our sin will increase if God refrains from hindering us in our quest for sinful pleasure. Let me read that again. The intensity of our sin will increase if God refrains from hindering us in our quest for sinful pleasure. I want to read a statement. 25 to 30 years ago, I was writing a study questions for a small group Bible study on the book of Jude. And somewhere in that study, I came across this statement. And this statement was put out by the Minnesota Crime Commission. Minnesota Crime Commission. Do you think, and I don't know anything about the Minnesota Crime Commission, but do you think that this probably is a religious organization? I wouldn't think so. I think they probably get some government money somewhere, I reckon. I doubt if the people who make up this commission are Baptist preachers. I just doubt it. But I want you to listen to what they said, and listen closely. Every baby starts life as a little savage. Savage. You know, like Geronimo? Every baby starts life as a little savage. He is completely selfish and self-centered. Are you with me so far? He wants what he wants when he wants it. His bottle, his mother's attention, his playmate's toy, his uncle's watch, deny him these wants, and he seethes with rage and aggressiveness, which would be murderous were he not so helpless. He is dirty. He has no morals, no knowledge, no skills. This means that all children, not just certain children, are born delinquent. If permitted to continue in the self-centered world of his infancy, given free rein to his impulsive actions to satisfy his wants. Did you catch all those conditions? Let me read them one more time. If permitted to continue in the self-centered world of his infancy, given free rein to his impulsive actions to satisfy his wants, if that were to happen, every child, they say, would grow up a criminal, a thief, a killer, a rapist. To not be, I assume, a religious organization, they are very theologically sound. Susan and I, a few years ago, went on our way back from the Creation Museum, went by somewhere, I think somewhere in Alabama, to Helen Keller's home place. Everyone knows Helen Keller, right? Born blind, deaf, and mute as a result of being blind and deaf, I suppose. But she could make sounds, just couldn't speak English when she was a kid. Her parents, and I may not have all my facts right, so if somebody knows more about this, you can write me a letter afterwards or something. Her parents were at their wits' end as to how to teach her, how to communicate with her, how to do all these things that she needed to be to do. At 7 years old, if I remember right, we were on, they kind of told you all this history as you went through the tour in this house. She, sitting down to eat a meal, and she's 7 years old, she's not sitting in her mama's lap or a high chair, was a war of breaking dishes, throwing stuff, just angry. Her hair, she was dirty, she was nasty because they couldn't give her a, hold her down to give her a bath sufficiently. Her hair was just matted with dirt and filth. They were at their wits' end as to how to help this girl. I know she was deaf. I know she was blind. But that description of this little girl is what the Minnesota Crime Commission is saying. Her parents were trying. You remember the lady's name that helped her? We don't know her name. I mean, some of you do. Ann Sullivan. Let me tell you, I admire Helen Keller. But to me, the hero in her life was Ann Sullivan. To take this 7-year-old wild child, angry wild child who could not see, hear, or speak, and nurture her, give her life to her, is incredible. Sometimes when God takes his hand off of our life, some of us have experience dealing with family members, maybe children, grandchildren, who I don't know who it may be. They will not heed wisdom. They will not listen. And there are times when you take your hands out and let them go to their own devices. God appears from these verses, does the same thing. This is the point. God at times, both individually and perhaps nationally, and perhaps is a better word than nationally, but gives men over. We see that three times in these verses. And I want you to see what he gives them over to. He doesn't give them over to more licks. You know what I'm saying? You get 4 licks for this. You do it again, you get 8 licks. You know, when you're getting a spanking. It's not that. God doesn't give them over to more punishment. It's not what it says. I want you, as we read them, I want you to see what God gives them over to. The first one is found in verse 24. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness. God gave them up to wickedness. God gave them up to practice what they wanted to practice. Verse 26, for this cause God gave them up to vile affections. Not punishment, but to vile affections. God gave them up and let them do what they wanted to do. Let them do their evil intentions of their heart. And verse 28, even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind, a depraved mind. These are progressively worse, it seems. So, what do we have? Men don't like God. They hate God. They despise God. They despise what they can see about God in nature. They hate it. So God lets them go. Lets them do what they want to do. Number 6. Men, thinking that this new freedom, God gave them up. Hallelujah. I can do what I want to do. Men, thinking this new freedom is a result of their superior genius. Remember, they're enlightened. They know everything. So they see all of this. God lets me do this. Somehow I'm able to do this. In our country, it would be seen at the ballot box. Right? We vote immorality in. And we think it's because a result of our enlightened behavior, our enlightened nature. They rush headlong into destructive behavior and the eventual disintegration of families and nations. You can think of a number of examples of this. I'm going to give you one. Roe versus Wade. 40 years ago or 50 years ago or however long that it was, when abortion was made legal in the United States, enlightened people who backed that thought, we are arriving. We as a nation are arriving. And yet, the result has been destruction. The result not only is in the loss of life, but it's in the devaluing of life. It's in an attitude that you really don't matter that much. It's in a hedonistic attitude of, I want pleasure for myself. I'm going to run through these points on under this list. Their foolish hearts are darkened. When God gives you up and gives you over to your uncleanness, to your sin, to desires, your heart becomes darker and darker. You become a fool, verse 22. You dishonor your body, verse 24. Women pervert the natural use of their bodies, verse 26. Now this very much implies lesbian homosexual behavior. But I didn't put those terms in there because somebody might say, well, it doesn't really specifically say that. No, it doesn't. But the next one is pretty clear. Men practice sodomy and homosexuality. I have yet to find someone who wanted to justify homosexuality from the scripture deal with Romans 1. It clearly states that when God gives you over to your uncleanness and gives over a civilization, a society to uncleanness, one of the things he may do is give you over to homosexual behavior. That is a judgment of God. That's what these verses tell us. God's wrath is revealed, and one way it is revealed is by a society who embraces homosexuality. He also mentions in this verse that this particular sin has its own judgment. They receive in themselves the error of their ways. Now, a lot of people think that it's a reference to AIDS. I don't know if it is or not. But there is certainly the perverted practice of homosexuality can lead to a lot of health issues. The reign of godless hedonism. Do you see that list of things there? Now, as we've gone through all this, you know, if you're like me, you're thinking, I'm not that way. I'm not that bad. I want you to read this list and kind of mentally check off the things that you are guilty of. Beginning in verse 29, being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication. In the average Christian church in America, that eliminates half the people already right there. Fornication. How many of human beings, American citizens, have practiced fornication? We're already just about eliminated everybody, right? Goes on. Wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, proud, boasters. By this time, everyone in this room has checked off something. Checked off several, more than likely. Inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents. That gets all the kids. Without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affections, implacable, unmerciful. A long list. I don't know how much you know about the Mayan civilization, and I don't know a whole lot, but it's always kind of intrigued me. The Mayan people were a highly sophisticated had a highly sophisticated civilization. The way I understand it, they had a calendar, and this is 1,000 years B.C. to 1,000 years A.D., somewhere in that time frame, if I remember correctly. They had a calendar that covered 365 days a year. They had machines that were did the same thing as our calculators. They could follow the orbit of stars. They were very intelligent people. But eventually, they also began to kill their children and offer them to God. They also eventually began to be a perverted in their minds. And their civilization was destroyed. I've read several articles on people trying to figure out what happened to the Mayans. And most of them have come to the conclusion that it was either deforestation of their land or drought. Maybe so. But I suspect those people who are trying to figure all this out can see themselves in Romans 1. They do not like to retain God in their knowledge. They're not willing to consider that perhaps the destruction of the Mayan civilization had a spiritual element to it. God may have used a drought, but I suspect the decline and the disappearance of the Mayan civilization was a spiritual thing. It was a judgment from God on their wicked behavior. He may have used drought, he may have used whatever. And I ask myself, when I look at the United States of America, when I look at the world, when I look at modern countries, they say that our knowledge, technological knowledge, doubles in, I don't forget how many years, but it's a short period of time. In the last 50 or 60 years, our knowledge has doubled every, nobody knows, do you? I want to say it's like 10 years, okay? A short period of time. And yet with all of this exponential increase in intelligence and in knowledge and in technology, do you see a world that is nicer? Do you see a world that's character is improving? Do you see a world that is gracious to their fellow citizens? Do you see a world that is cleaner? Do you see a world that is healthier? No, we may be living longer, and I think even they're saying now that's turning. I'm not so sure that our civilization and our nation is on its way up. We may be on our way down. Because God has given us up to uncleanness. Now, very quickly, if all I've said is right, how come I see good in the world? Do you see good in the world? I do. I see a lot of good. If all this is right that I've been saying, then why do I see good? Here's the key. Not everybody is at the same stage of judgment. God may be just beginning passing his judgment on this person, and this person already may be in the gutter. So I'm saying everybody's at different ages, different stages, and sometimes the second thing here is God's judgment comes in varying time spans. Sometimes God's judgment, he may take a lifetime to inflict it and to place it upon this person. And another person, they may experience God's judgment in a moment of time. Let me give you an example. I know two men that have these things in common. They both live in Cleburne County. They both were Baptist preachers. They both were married and had several kids. They had all those things in common. And they both came to a point in their early adult life that they came out of the closet and embraced homosexuality. All those things in common. One man is still living. He's been out of the closet for 40 years. Still living. I can carry it to him and show him to you. The other man came out of the closet. I used to meet with this guy. We used to study the scriptures together. We used to pray together. He came out of the closet, left his wife, and in 2 or 3 years, he was dead. Dead from AIDS or complication to AIDS. I was a pallbearer at his funeral. Sometimes God's judgment is quick. Sometimes it's even, from the bystander, hard to even see it. And yet the older gentleman that's still living, it has wreaked havoc on his children. I can see it in his son's face every time I see him. I see people who love God. Don't you? Why do they love God? It's because God first loved them. We all, the reason we see good is because we all sometimes are somewhat effective as salt to the earth. Because we are Christians and we carry around our Christian values, there are that influences the world to some extent. My children were raised supposedly in a Christian home, and the result of that was they grew up with some measure of fearing God because they were taught that. All the good that you see in this world, every bit of the good you see in this world is an expression of God's grace. Every bit of it. And it's seen even in wicked people. God has given children, young children, a love for their parents almost universally. And it doesn't matter what kind of parents they have. Do you know that? It doesn't matter how sorry they are, their kids love them. And there is not a parent in this room who hasn't benefited from that fact. God gives His grace to us, sometimes through an unbeliever. So, in a nutshell, here's what this text teaches us. All men, by nature, hate God. All men, by nature, completely lack the capacity and desire within themselves to rightfully worship God. All men will surely perish under God's judgment if left to their own devices and desires, and probably sooner rather than later. That's not the gospel. But we ought to hope there is one, shouldn't we? Now, you might look at yourself and say, well, I haven't done all these things. I haven't either. But I've got the capacity to do it. So do you. Don Tibbett has the capacity to be as evil as he could be. I have that capacity. Ted Gibson has that capacity. You remove all constraints from us, all inhibitions, every guilt trip that anybody could put us on, take all that stuff away, give us free rein. Do whatever we want to do. We'll start down that path. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word. God, sometimes it's hard to believe. God, I just thank you to help us to grasp this. Let it sink in. Let it not overwhelm us. God, let us see the value, the worth of the gospel. Amen.